This is Audible.
You're listening to the audio production of Stars of Alabama by Sean Dietrich, published by Thomas Nelson and read by the author.
Book 1, Chapter 1, Hollering. Paul Folger listened to Louisville bark. The dog's black and tan fur dripped with water that had turned her hair curly. The dog had been swimming in Rabbit Creek all morning. She loved to swim. Louisville was old, lean, all ears, long jowls with some white around her snout. The old girl howled for all she was worth, staring straight into the woods that sat behind the creek, which forked into Mobile Bay. She was a tracking dog, the most obedient dog Paul had ever trained. If Paul would have told the dog to build a 10-foot sandcastle, Louisville would have gone hunting for a shovel and bucket. The morning air had an oyster taste to it. Not a fresh oyster taste, more like a horrible canned oyster, the kind Paul's father ate. The air surrounding the bay always had that sort of taste. It was a smell that could gag a goat, a smell that only got worse when the weather got hot and the wind died. A day like today. Louisville heard something. So did Paul. A high-pitched shriek cut the air. They listened to the screams together, man and dog. Paul knew what Louisville was thinking. She wanted Paul to send her into the woods. But Paul was in no mood for tracking. "Ain't nothing serious, Louise," said Paul. "Just simmer down." They stood on a shore littered with brown seaweed where the creek began and the bay ended. The sand near the water's edge was so soft a man's boots could sink halfway into the earth. Paul was up to his ankles in it. He looked across the bay, across the gray water, at the yellow grass that stretched sideways next to the great Mobile Bay. The morning sun was strong enough to fry your skin. Paul's pale face was freckled and ruined from a lifetime in this sunlight. He'd been a redhead long ago, before his hair turned white, and the sun made his skin look like it was covered in buckshot. Louisville barked. Though it was really more of a bang, Louisville was like most bloodhounds. She didn't bark. It was beneath her. Instead, she used her low voice and it carried across the water, only to be interrupted by the cicadas and the crickets. The morning insect sounds were coming from all directions in swells. Loud and soft, loud, soft. A man could get hypnotized if he closed his eyes. "Quit it, Louise," said Paul. "Ain't got time for your yapping." But Paul knew Louisville was never wrong. Paul was listening with his eyes closed, letting the sounds of the world swirl around him. Vern stood straight and called down from the roof of the mill house in the distance. "What's Lou barking about?" "How should I know?" Vern was the tallest black man Paul had ever known, and from high up on the roof where he stood, he looked like a portrait of John Henry, only skinnier. Below the mill house, the truck door was open so Vern could listen to the radio. It was Wednesday. Vern always listened to radio preaching on Wednesdays, and he listened to it at a volume that was loud enough to affect the weather. The sounds of a hollering voice from a tinny speaker competed with the baying from Louisville's throat. Her voice was as deep as that of a full-grown baritone man. "Would you turn that radio off? Between that stupid preacher and Lou's barking, I can't hear nothing but hot air."
"Oh, well, sorry, Paul."
"Now, quit your sorrying, Vern. It's a bad habit." Vern's bare feet gripped the roof while he walked. His lanky frame crawled the edge like an acrobat. Paul watched him climb down, three rungs at a time. His sharp features made him look almost like a bronze statue. He lowered himself on the ladder and turned the radio off in the truck. Vern stood beside Paul and cupped his ear.
"What are we listening for? Don't hear nothing."
"You wouldn't. You can't hear nothing."
"Huh?"
"Exactly. That daggum radio made you deaf." There was the sound again. It cut through the humidity. Louisville howled. Paul tugged Louisville's collar and said, "Okay, honey, I hear you." She stopped howling. Then he looked across the creek one more time, making his ears as big as he could, like a dog would do. When he was a boy, his father used to say Paul was part dog, and in some ways this was true. Paul felt something kindred with the canine, and he'd proven this by squandering his life breeding and training tracking dogs. It started as a boyhood hobby, but soon he was trailing escaped prisoners and missing children, and squirrels, foxes, and coons. "Keep laying them shingles," yelled Paul. "I'd better go see what she's making a fuss about." "You going into the woods alone?" Vern called back. "You's too old."
Old?
Huh?
I was asking who you was calling old.
Vern was already unfastening his tool belt.
I told you I'll do it, just let me go.
Now hold on, Vern. I ain't some old man. I was walking them woods before you was even a sniffling your pa's nose.
Better let me go, Pa. I was younger.
You ain't that much younger. Vern was at least 25 years, Paul's junior.
Something bad could happen to you out there, Paul. You could break a leg or something.
Vern, now you stay where you is. That is an order.
Huh?
I said stay put.
Paul hollered loud enough to break his own neck.
Foot? Whose foot? Yours or mine?
You're either deaf or stubborn. I can't figure out which.
Vern ignored him and marched toward the woods in a straight line. Vern was middle-aged and quiet. But if it weren't for the gray on Vern's woolly temples, he would have seemed like a teenager. A stubborn teenager. Louisville whimpered at Vern. She started trotting through the high grass toward the trees. Paul hollered,
Lou, you stay here with me. If I can't go, then you can't go. We're a team.
Louisville paused to look at Paul. She was thinking about this. Then she glanced at Vern, who was moving farther away. Paul clapped and pointed at the ground by his bare feet.
Back here, girl. Come here to me now.
Louisville was old. She'd spent a lifetime doing whatever Paul told her. She blinked at him. Then she turned and followed Vern. Chapter 2. Good Girl. Louisville trotted ahead of Vern, pausing to sniff. She was a smart girl. Vern remembered when Paul had trained her as a puppy. The animal could track human scent and game in the air or on the ground. Louisville was getting white around her nose, and Vern could tell she wasn't as sharp as she used to be. She ran in hurried zigzags through the woods, looking, sniffing, sneezing, pawing, thinking. Serious. Vern knew what she wanted. She wanted the praise that finding prizes would bring her. She wanted to come trotting out of the woods holding a dead squirrel in her mouth so Paul would pat her on the head and say, Good girl, Lou. Those three little words made Lou's whole life worth the trouble. The high-pitched screaming cut the cricket noises. Vern didn't know which direction to walk, so he followed Rabbit Creek. He pointed his good ear toward the sound. He stopped every few steps to focus. He closed his eyes. The screams stopped. The only sound he heard was a woodpecker smacking its nose against a tree. Maybe whatever was making the noise had gotten spooked and stopped hollering. Maybe it worked itself free and escaped from whatever snare it was in. Or maybe it had died. Vern thought about turning around and going back. But not Louisville. The old girl stopped and sniffed the air. She tilted her nose toward the sun and held her tail straight up. The woodpecker made a sound again. Louisville followed the bird sound. Then she took in more wind through her nose. She darted into the woods, head up, nose to the breeze, moving fast. The morning sun was glaring at Vern. He could hardly see in the early light. He spotted the woodpecker making all the noise on a nearby limb. The bird was dotted with black spots and was blood red at the corners of its mouth with long, straight tail feathers. It opened its mouth and let out a loud sound, then flew away. He watched it soar above the trees, catching flashes of its red in the daylight. Louisville lurched forward in a clumsy run. She ran like a dog who was 10 years younger than she was. Vern followed, moving as fast as his big legs would let him. He lost sight of Louisville in the green. He paused every few moments to listen for her baying, but none came. So Vern stood in one place, waiting for a sound, cursing beneath his breath at his bad sense of hearing. He waited for nearly 19 whole courses of Keep on the Sunny Side, watching the creek water before him move in strange patterns. He wanted to call for Lou, but that would have confused the dog. Besides, it didn't work that way. During a hunt, the dog calls you. Then came howling. He followed the sound. He saw something in the distance, something big. A white square under the limbs of fat trees. Louisville was facing the drop cloth, slung over a low branch. It was a tent, the kind hobos used. Louisville howled louder when she saw Vern approaching. He was moving slow, carrying a heavy pine branch he'd found, balancing it on his shoulder like a slugger. He didn't know what or who he was approaching. The last thing he wanted was to find unfriendly drifters who didn't care for his color. He called out to them. Hello? There was no answer. Anybody there? We friendly? No response.
I'm friendly. I ain't gonna hurt nobody.
When he neared the tent, Louisville was walking so close behind him, she almost knocked him over. And then he saw it. The noise was coming from a little mouth. Louisville wandered toward the child. She pressed her nose against the tiny white thing that was squirming in a bed of pine needles. The baby's mop of orange hair was thick and messy. Its hands were outstretched. The child looked just like the sweet little Jesus boy himself.
Good girl, Lou, said Vern. Good girl.
Chapter 3. Marigold the Magnificent. She wasn't stealing. Or maybe she was. Marigold wasn't sure if this was, in fact, thievery, since this was her first time stealing. She never realized stealing was an actual skill until now. She had no idea it would be so difficult to behave naturally. She grabbed two small sacks of pinto beans from the store shelf. She felt the charge travel through her body, a sickening jolt that made her hands tremble. This was definitely not stealing. She was hungry, and that made it different. This was borrowing. She glanced behind her, then stuffed the borrowed beans into her blouse. The beans weighed more than she had thought they would. After adjusting the packages in her brassiere, her chest gained 5 inches on the left side. The lump in her blouse drooped halfway down to her waist. She adjusted her renegade bosom, but it kept heading toward the floor. She walked through the general store with careful steps and an unnatural smile on her face. She was larger than other 15-year-old girls, and she was embarrassed by this. Her brothers had teased her about it. Her hips were too wide, her chest was too big, and her legs were thick around the ankles. God, in all his cruelty, had seen fit to top her off with a dollop of fire-red hair and freckles that looked like someone had rolled her in confetti. Her brothers called her Marigold the Magnificent, and she hated them for it. They might as well have called her the Great Wall of China. Her size, her skin, her hair were her curses. Why don't you go suck an egg? She'd often advise her brothers just before she made a serious attempt to fracture important bones in their bodies. Mainly, their ribs. Ribs were always a good choice. She almost broke her brother Tom's foot once by stomping on it. She hadn't meant to hurt him like that, but he never called her Marigold the Magnificent again. Marigold had gotten bigger after she gave birth to Maggie. Her hips had become too big for the cotton dresses she wore. Her whole body had changed. In fact, she felt like a stranger in her own skin ever since Father had done the terrible thing he had done to her. The baby had changed her. She had purple stretch marks on every part of her. When her milk came in, she got even bigger, and it made her feel like she was a household appliance from the Sears and Roebuck catalog. She patted her brassiere, adjusting the beans. This was definitely not stealing. Stealing was what bad people did. She wasn't bad. When she wasn't breaking ribs or ankles, she was a good person, honest, polite, courteous. Without this food, Marigold would die in the woods. And what would happen to Maggie? She wandered down the general store aisle. She let her fingers run along the canned goods on the shelves. She stopped at the canned herring and sardines. The hunger inside her was crippling, and she had strange cravings ever since she'd had Maggie. Pickles were at the top of her list. She caught herself dreaming about pickles sometimes. If she could have taken a bath in pickle juice, she would have. And oysters, she craved those. Even though she'd only had them a few times in her life, she looked at a can of Acme oysters. She wished she could smuggle them without being noticed, but her brassiere couldn't handle any more weight. The man behind the counter was watching her. She could feel his eyes. A cigarette was between his lips and his arms were folded. "Do you need help?" he said.
"No, sir," she said.
The man's eyes didn't leave her. Hina raised an eyebrow. "What are you looking for?"
"Oh, nothing."
"You must be hunting something. You've been pacing for nearly 15 minutes. The beans were tugging her collar downward. Her enormous chest was sinking. She wanted to leave the beans on the floor and run for the woods and head straight for Maggie. She wanted to forget about all this borrowing. She wanted to scoop her baby in her arms and get far away from this town and never, never come back. But she stood still. The man's face got harder. He removed his glasses. Little girl, what's underneath your... She started for the door. She could feel the beans falling toward her ribs. She felt them slip past her belly. She made a strained face, willing the beans to stop sliding downward. A bag of beans dropped and plopped on the floor between her feet. She ran as fast as she could. He sprang after her, caught her by the waist. To her horror, the man reached down her blouse and removed the remaining sack of beans. She moved by reflex. She heard a crack and was almost certain she'd broken his ribs. He fell to the floor and held his side. His face was contorted with pain. "Why, you thief," he said, coughing. "You're trying to rip me off." "No, I'm not," she said. "I just wanted to try him out." She sprinted down the street and she almost got away, but she ran face first into a big man who was walking toward her. She collided with him so hard she knocked him over and lost her balance. "Stop her!" the store owner yelled. The big man pinned Marigold to the ground. She spit at him until she ran out of saliva. "Go suck an egg," she yelled. "Get the sheriff," the store owner hollered. "She's stealing." "I wasn't stealing." When the store owner got near, the big man looked at Marigold with kind eyes. "If you behave, honey, I'll let you go," he said. "You promise to behave?" Marigold could feel the sweetness in him. She could tell things about people that they didn't even know about themselves. It was a talent from her birth. She nodded her head. "I swear I'll behave." "Okay, then." The man let his weight off her and wore a sheepish look on his face. "I'm sorry if I hurt you, honey. Are you all right?" She hit the man hard enough to break his ribs. And that's how Marigold landed in jail for the night. Chapter 4. Child of the Plains. The Kansas prairie was wide and gold and dry. The acres stretched for miles and miles, uninterrupted by even the smallest tree. The plains were hot and dusty. It was beautiful in some parts, but most areas were not. The scenery could be boring enough to drive a man nuts. The Kansan skies could get so blue they looked purple, and that was all a boy could see. Sky. Sky. And what's that in the distance? More sky. Unless the dust storms were in the air, then you couldn't see sky at all. In fact, you couldn't do anything but lock yourself in a closet with a wet rag over your face and pray. The dust could get so bad it killed young children. Child-sized caskets were common in this world. Dust pneumonia was killing kids, animals, and old people. 14-year-old Coot waited behind the canvas tent while the dust swirled in little drifts. It wasn't a bad storm, only a minor sandstorm. He thumbed through a pack of baseball cards. The last storm had been worse. It had destroyed parts of Deerfield. The wind was so hard it turned a car over on its side and ate the paint off the doors. Since then, the sky had been light blue, without clouds, but such pleasant skies never lasted for long. The baseball cards came from Blake. It didn't matter which town they were preaching in, Blake always had a radio going or a newspaper unfolded in front of him. He was a baseball man, inside and out. He passed this weakness on to Coot. Coot carried these cards everywhere. The grainy photos of men in wool caps wearing heroic looks on their stone faces. On the reverse sides were all sorts of numbers. Batting averages is what they were, Blake had told him. Coot had only seen one professional baseball game. Blake had taken him to a game in Wichita to see the Monarchs play the Birmingham Black Barons in an exhibition. Players in the Negro Leagues were the best players in the world, Blake explained. They played a different variety of ball than the other leagues. It was exciting and loud. That day was the best day of Coot's entire life, hands down. Until that day, he'd only seen community leagues of local men who had other jobs. These men played baseball professionally. When Coot was a toddler, Blake had outlined the rules of the game using a pencil and a peanut bag. It only took one explanation for Coot to grasp the game entirely. "My goodness," Blake had said to Coot. "You got a camera for a mind, boy." And this was true. Only his mind was more like a Victrola than it was a camera. He could remember anything as long as he heard it. It only worked with his ears. His memory was so good he could remember entire games he'd heard on the radio, play by play, word
by word. Sometimes he would play a game in his head before he went to sleep. He liked the way baseball announcers talked. He had special words for things that happened on the field. "Here she comes," an announcer would say over a small radio speaker. "The Bugs Bunny ball takes the baseball right home. King Carl Morris swings. Lord have mercy, folks. The king gets caught looking." That was the radio's way of saying, "Strike three." Or an announcer would say, "He's pitching from the stretch, and there's the delivery. Crack! Goodbye, Daddy. The train is leaving the station." And that meant a home run had been hit. The king rounds the bases and waves at his fans. "Folks, this home run is brought to you by Dan's Hardware, folks. Don't forget to visit Dan's Hardware for all your hardware needs." Coot stared at the baseball player's face on the card. He touched the card and wished he were far away in a stadium wearing a cotton uniform playing ball. But that was not his lot in life. Coot was interrupted by a hard smack on his ear. He dropped the cards and stumbled backward. E.P. Willer stood over Coot and kicked dust over the cards until they were covered. E.P.'s wide body towered over Coot like a slab of rock. "Put those things down," he said. "You're about to preach. Someone might have seen you out here lollygagging." He smacked Coot one more time for good measure. E.P.'s hand was so fat it felt more like having a disagreement with a skillet. E.P. peeked inside the tent flap. He was checking the size of the crowd. It wasn't a big crowd, a far cry from the multitudes Coot had preached for in Emporia. Blake was standing on the stage, shouting into a megaphone at the crowd. He was wearing a white shirt that was drenched in sweat. He was warming up the audience for Coot. "Saints of God," Blake hollered, "a generation base and wicked seeking solace in times of trial. Shall you be found ready when the good Lord calleth, or shall we be caught looking when the Lord throws a final strike?" That made Coot smile. He knew Blake had only said that for Coot's benefit. Blake always introduced Coot before each service, using that growling voice he was known for. And after a long introduction, Blake finally got to Coot's cue, and the crowd went nuts. "You're on," said E.P. Then he smacked Coot on the back of his head. "Get your head out of the stands, boy." E.P. pushed Coot forward, and Coot stumbled through the canvas tent flaps. He looked back at E.P., who glared through a sliver of daylight between the tent flaps. Last week, Coot's collections had been small. E.P. had beaten Coot with his belt so hard it left purple marks on his shoulder blades. Coot took center stage. There were 62 people in the audience. That's what Blake had told him earlier. Each looked at Coot. They were Kansans. White-haired farmers, tired housewives, miserable migrants, those infected with dust and pneumonia. They all met Coot with curious faces, and he could practically hear what they were thinking. He'd been preaching since his 7th birthday, when he was ordained by E.P. He'd spent enough time on stages to know what people were thinking. They were scared. That's what was at the core of these people. They were terrified of dust that hovered above the world. They drank the dust, ate the dust. The dust suffocated their children and wilted their food. He was used to their dry faces, and he was used to preaching the money right out of their pockets like E.P. taught him to do. Coot closed his eyes tight. He reached one hand into the air and made a fist. He squeezed the air so tight that his knuckles went pale. Drama was what he wanted here, the silent kind. The longer you waited, the bigger the reaction. He held his hand high and waited. Silence fell on the room. Bubbling chatter turned to stillness, and even though Coot's eyes were closed, he knew every eye was on that fist. He drew in a sharp breath. More waiting. Silence fell over the crowd so that Coot could hear them breathing. A woman in the back corner was wheezing. Then Coot said in a slow, loud voice,
"Oh God, it is thee we ask for help. We, thy people who hath sought you in the hour of a terrible storm."
Nobody reacted. No amens. Only a few people clearing their throats. Tough crowd. So Coot waited longer. The pause was the most powerful tool the preacher had. If you pause long enough, people would start weeping of their own volition. E.P. once told him that pure silence could do more than a whole sermon. E.P. once said that he'd seen J. Wilbur Chaplin preach in Atlanta and say only 10 words and the place came unglued. If you kept a room silent for long enough, people would either start bawling or fainting. If they cried, it was a good service. If they fainted, it was a great one. Coot's silence lasted for another 3 minutes. Not a single chair creak, dry cough, or ladybug sneeze was heard. Coot went on in a soft voice. Breathe fire from heaven on your people, O Lord. Shake the dust from their bones. Coot had just come up with that last line. A nice touch, he thought. A woman in the audience stood first. Coot stared at her. Normally, he would have stretched his hand toward her and shouted, "The power of the Lord!" But he was feeling a little more dramatic today. He threw his hand back and formed an imaginary baseball bat in his fists. Then he swung toward her like he was swinging at a four-seam fastball. The woman fell backward just like she'd been paid to do. Only, she put more emphasis into this fall than she usually did. Coot had heard she'd been given a pay increase a few days earlier, ever since her sciatica started acting up and she threatened to leave. Another man stood, eyes closed, palms toward the sky. Coot motioned his hand toward the man like a baseball player swinging at a seventh-inning pitch, full count, bottom of the inning. "The power of the Lord!" Coot shouted. "Crack goodbye, Daddy. That train is leaving the station!" The man fell backward. The man's nickname was Chowder. Coot had known him for most of his life. Sometimes Chowder could fall so well people thought he was dead. When Chowder fell, the crowd gasped. Several people started crying. Crying was good. Coot was batting 100. Another man rose to his feet. Now, this man was a real thing, a stranger, a farmer. Farmers were hard to read. You could never tell how farmers would react. They were reserved people by nature, quiet, steady, and skeptical. Some wouldn't fall down even if you cut their legs off with a jackknife. Then again, others would cluck like chickens for Jesus. Coot breathed inward and swung his imaginary bat. "The power of God!" The man just blinked for a few seconds. Finally, he collapsed and wiggled on the floor. Home run. Coot rounds the bases and waves at his fans, folks. This home run moment is brought to you by Dan's Hardware, folks. Don't forget to visit Dan's for all your hardware needs. The entire tent started hollering words that weren't words at all. They were syllables, speaking in tongues, they called it. It was still a new thing to Coot's ears, but whenever this happened, Coot knew he had them where he wanted them. Coot recited a Spanish poem that E.P. had taught him years ago. He told Coot to use this poem whenever a congregation started tongue-talking. After this, Coot recited a limerick in Russian. This was a real crowd-pleaser, because Russian has a lot of weird sounds in it. He had no idea what the poem was about, but he liked the way it felt on his tongue. Coot preached for 30 minutes. He shouted. He quoted long, intricate passages from the Gospel of Matthew, the Book of Revelation, and even something from Aesop's Fables. 23 people came down for salvation. 10 walked out of the tent in disgust. 14 claimed to be healed. One woman claimed she'd regained her hearing. Another man threw his walking stick away. One woman from Syracuse asked Coot to cast a demon out of her husband, who was a well-known jerk. Coot had never done this before, but he figured it was easy enough. The service was a success. Still, these were poverty-stricken people, poor as dirt farmers without much money in their pockets, and these were hard times. The ushers only collected $6.92 from the crowd. It wasn't nearly enough to make E.P. happy. It wasn't even enough to pay rent on the field that the tent was in. E.P. beat Coot with the buckle end of his belt until it chipped a bone in Coot's neck. Chapter 5 Two Men and a Baby. Vern's big hand was twice the size of the baby's head. The baby was a newborn, but already had more red hair than most babies have.
"Yours?" shouted Paul. "You big stupid man, you can't raise a baby!"
Paul didn't have the patience nor the maternal sensitivity to have this kind of conversation.
"We have a half-shingle mill house that needs finishing and painting, and you want to start feeding babies?"
"She's all alone, Paul."
"That ain't my problem. Besides, she probably belongs with somebody who ain't gonna be too happy when they find out you stole her."
"They left her."
"How do you know?"
"She told me."
Vern rocked the baby and stared the little girl in the eyes.
"She mine now."
Paul removed his hat and wiped the sweat from his head.
"How are we gonna paint Mr. Dreyfus' mill house by tomorrow morning if you got a baby latched onto your teat?"
"She need me.
She mine. She needs her mama, and she's probably on her way back to this tent right now. Now put the baby down before her folks get here and carve us up with axes for manhandling their young'un.
I could be her mama.
Put her down, Vern. I can love her.
Paul removed his hat and fanned his face. He had heard of families leaving their children behind. These hard times made people do awful things.
I can do all things Mama can do, Vern went on. She's a sweet girl.
You've lost your mind. We got work to do, and here you are.
Sweet, sweet girl. Yes, she is.
You ought to hear yourself. You sound like a blaming fool.
Boogaboo, 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 boogaboo.
You belong in a nut house, you know that?
Boogaboo, 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 boogaboo.
Put that child down before someone catches us.
You want to hold her, Paul?
Paul pushed the brim of his hat upward. He thought about this for a moment.
No, Vern, I don't want to hold her. I got work to do, and so do you.
Vern extended the baby toward Paul. Paul took the child in his arms. Her eyelids cracked open. She focused her lazy eyes on him. Violet eyes. Paul had never seen violet eyes before. They were the color of a night sky just before the sun rises and cuts through the blackness of it all.
See? I told you she's a real sweet girl. Now give her back.
Paul stepped away from Vern with the child held against his chest.
Go get your own dadgum baby.
Chapter 6. The Runner.
The sheriff released Marigold from the jailhouse at noon. In 2 minutes, she was darting toward the woods, passing storefronts, pedestrians, and lampposts. The town was a pretty one, but she didn't pause long enough to take it in. She ran past the brick facades, shops, and clapboard homes on the side streets. Her heart hurt so bad it threatened to give out. She cussed herself. She cried. She cussed herself some more.
How could I leave Maggie? She thought. I'm a stupid, stupid girl.
In her mind, she could see Maggie's purple eyes and copper hair. She felt ashamed before her own conscience. Her body was growing weak from hunger. The night before, she'd refused to eat or drink in the jailhouse. It was a form of protest. She'd hoped the sheriff would feel sorry for her and let her go free, or at least be impressed by her magnificent courage. Instead, he ate her supper right in front of her and said, "Suit yourself, you ungrateful little brat."
Stupid, stupid girl.
She was stupid, weak, and thirsty. That's what she was. The sun was draining her body. Her mouth was getting dry. When she reached the edge of town, the thirst made her tongue swell. She stopped near a white house surrounded by oak trees. She caught her breath in the shade and held her stomach to keep from vomiting. She touched her chest and felt something ache in her bosom.
Maggie, she said to herself, I'm coming.
She collapsed beside an oak. Her legs refused to move. They were numb. She looked at the leaves above her that formed a crisscross design blocking out the sunlight. She could see clouds through the little openings between the leaves.
Please,
she said to the clouds. She didn't know who she was talking to or what she was saying. Whoever it was up there behind the clouds, they certainly weren't concerned with her. When she had given birth to Maggie in the middle of the woods, screaming at the pine trees, squeezing a low branch with both hands, there had been no heavenly help. Not even a ray of sunlight. No flicker from the sky. Nothing. She decided in these moments of labor that she didn't believe in God, whatever he was. And even if she had, she wouldn't have liked the old man anyway. But old habits die hard.
Help,
she whispered. Behind the white clapboard house, she saw birds drinking from a white bowl beneath a tin gutter spout. Starlings stood perched on the rim. They ducked their heads into the water, then shook it from their feathers. Then a bird jumped into the bowl, breast deep. It ruffled its feathers like a dog drying its coat. Marigold wandered toward the birds on weak knees. Her thirst was so bad, it made her lips feel sore. The birds did not flutter away from her when they saw her. One unfearing starling looked at her with curious eyes, its head tilted. Marigold's arms and legs gave out. She collapsed on her stomach. When she fell, the birds leapt into the air and spread their wings outward in the open sunlight, and they were gone. She held the rim to her mouth and drank the water. She became dizzy. Her vision dimmed, and she saw a million sparks swimming in her eyes.
She sat down and her dress was covered in dirt. She passed out. Then she awoke. To her surprise, she awoke on her feet. She was running again. It was almost like sleep running. She was unaware of what she was doing. She was following some sort of motherly instinct she didn't know she had. Marigold was a fast girl. Her large thighs might have been ridiculed by her brothers just before she sacrificed their ribs, but her legs were strong. They could beat any boy her age in a foot race and still have the strength left to wrestle. Marigold ran so fast her lungs hurt. The water had given her a surge of energy. She ran the dirt road until her heart felt like it was going to pop. Then her strength left her, all at once. She stopped and fell in the dust again. Her leg muscles throbbed and her stomach was sour.
"I'm coming, Maggie."
She forced herself upright, but only made it a few feet. She fell face first onto the road. Dust got in her mouth. There was nothing she could do. She could not will her legs to move. The hunger had finally caught up with her, and she believed this would kill her. She cried, but no tears came out. She was too dehydrated. Through some kind of stubbornness, she hoped she was wrong about God. She hoped something heavenly would watch over her baby, whether she believed it or not.
"Please," she whispered, "you can kill me, but take care of Maggie."
And in her haze, she thought she saw someone. He was tall, lanky. His hair was red on top, white on the sides. She could see him. She'd never seen him before. "Brave girl," he said. "Such a brave girl. Rest right here, brave girl." She was not brave. She knew that.
"I'm stupid,"
Marigold shouted through tears.
"Not brave. I'm so stupid."
"Rest, brave girl," he said. "You're such a brave girl." He stooped beside her and patted her hair. Then he disappeared.
"So this is how it will happen," she thought.
She would die from exhaustion and starvation. There would be no coming back. Then a feeling overwhelmed her.
"I'm sorry, Maggie," she forced out. "I'm so sorry. I'm sorry."
But the hateful sky didn't care how sorry she was. It only laughed at her. The redhead man disappeared. She was alone, and her world went black. Chapter 7. Wonder Boy. The caravan of vehicles rode the dark highway outside Greensburg. The flat fields were so big and long it was like riding on a light-colored sea. Coot had never seen the sea. All he'd ever known were dry fields, water shortages, hacking, dust, coughs, malnourished cattle, and poverty. And storm clouds that were made entirely of dirt. Storms so black they shut out the sun and only left a lightless hill behind them. But tonight wasn't dusty. In fact, he could see the stars in the violet sky, and that was a rarity in this part of the world. Often, dust clouds blocked out the stars so that the night sky looked like muddy pond water. He'd forgotten how magnificent the stars were. In the back of the covered trailer, Coot sat on a cot, a lantern on a hook above his bed, rocked, making the shadows inside the trailer move from side to side. The wagon bounced with the curves and bumps in the road. Coot stared at the headlights of the cars that were following them. The car directly behind the trailer was E.P.'s Hudson, a vehicle with chrome fenders and hand-painted letters on the door that read E.P. Willard's Gospel Troop. Blake pulled the canvas flap closed.
"Gotta keep it shut," said Blake. "You let the dust in."
"But there ain't no dust tonight."
"Well, I don't want it open in case there is."
He pressed a slab of beef over Coot's neck.
"How's that feeling?"
Coot shrugged. It hurt to shrug. Coot stared at the baseball cards he'd retrieved from the dirt. He admired the stoic faces in the glow of the lantern light. They looked like fearless soldiers, almost. Coot was the exact opposite. He was not fearless. Coot didn't know how to stand up for himself. He was quiet and soft-spoken when he wasn't on stage preaching. He wanted to be like one of the men on the cards. The baseball players all had strong nicknames, not dumb names like Coot, a name that was short for an even dumber name, Cooter. Who names their kid Cooter?
Who would ever take him seriously with a name that sounded like an inappropriate body part? Baseball players had nicknames that were real, like Big Jim or Little General or George the Lightning or Old Hoss. Coot wondered what it would feel like for someone to call him Old Hoss. Now that was a name that didn't sound like a dangling participle on the human body. For a moment, he tried on that name for size. Old Hoss, he said aloud. The name seemed a little big for him, he thought, but it did make him feel taller. The boy could get used to being an old hoss instead of a cooter. Coot knew that E.P. hadn't meant for the buckle of his belt to hit his neck like it did. It was an accident. But the metal struck, and it felt like someone had stabbed him. When the beating was over, Coot had touched his neck expecting blood, but there was no blood, only a burning neck. When Blake found Coot crying, he stormed after E.P., removing his own belt and flung it at E.P. like a whip, screaming at him. He landed several good licks before E.P. tackled the old man. The choir stood outside E.P.'s tent watching Blake blow a gasket. Blake was wiry, but tough. His thick handlebar mustache was bigger than he was, and his limbs were lanky. He'd done horse tricks and lasso tricks in a traveling Wild West show before he took up revival work, and he was fast. After their brief fight, Blake pinned E.P. on the ground and forced the big man to offer a grand apology in front of everybody. And E.P. did just that. He even worked up tears. Coot forgave him publicly, but Coot knew it was only theatrics. The lantern swung in the dark and made Coot dizzy. "Feeling any better?" asked Blake. Coot wasn't feeling any better. He felt like someone had lit a campfire on his neck. "Yeah," Coot said. "I feel much better." "You sure?" said Blake, placing an unlit cigar in his mouth. "You ain't just telling me what I want to hear. You always tell me what I want to hear."
"No. No, I'm better."
"You are not, I can tell."
"No, I'm fine, Blake, I swear."
Blake let out a laugh. Then he chewed on his cigar so hard it started to splinter in his mouth. "You're a liar."
"Why don't you never light them cigars?" asked Coot.
"Cost too much to light them, and in case you ain't noticed, we's poor." Blake removed the meat from Coot's neck. He inspected the patch of skin and touched it gently. "Is the pain right there?" asked Blake.
"To the left a little."
"E.P. deserves to rot in a shallow grave."
"He didn't mean for the buckle to hit me."
"Well, ain't he humanitarian of the year?" Blake flipped the meat so the cool side rested on Coot's neck. The coolness felt good, but did little to ease the burn. Coot stared at the cards and imagined his own face beneath the ball caps the men wore. He would have made a good ball player if God were real. He wasn't sure about this. He wished he would have seen fit to make him a ball player instead of a cooter.
"Blake, you think we can go to another baseball game if we ever get into Wichita again?"
Blake removed the crushed cigar from his mouth and spit out a few flakes. Then he touched Coot's cheek. "Got me another idea. When we get to Wichita, me and you's going to part ways with old E.P. Coot said nothing. He could hardly believe what he'd just heard. He'd been with E.P. since birth. His mother had been E.P.'s church organist. All he'd ever known was E.P. Willard's gospel troupe. The thought of leaving E.P. was terrifying and thrilling at the same time.
"Leave," said Coot. "Where will we go?"
"Far away from that man."
"But he's just upset. He'll get over it, and things will go back to normal."
"I heard your mother say the same thing too many times, Coot. He should have married her, you know." Blake stopped talking. It was as though there was something more he wanted to say but couldn't. Many times, Coot wanted to ask if E.P. were his real father. He had suspicions that wouldn't go away. But Coot never could build up enough courage to ask anyone flat out because he didn't want to know. He wanted even less to be related to that big ugly man.
"Where will we go off to, Blake?"
The light from the moving lantern made dark shadows on Blake's face. Blake leaned close. "You leave that to me." Coot let his mind wander toward the idea of never seeing E.P. again. He thought about what it would be like to be a normal 14-year-old who could play baseball or go to school or climb trees or maybe even have a girlfriend. E.P. did not permit climbing trees or baseball, and girls were considered worse than whiskey.
"We can go to baseball games?" asked Coot.
many as you want.
What if he catches us?
I just hope that fool tries.
He'll kill us, Blake. He'd really kill us.
Blake removed the meat from Coot's neck and touched his face. In some ways, Blake was the only friend Coot had ever known. Coot, you're almost a man now, and that means you've got to try to be brave for me. Don't mean you actually have to be brave, but being a man means you've got to try. Can you do that? Coot rolled this over the coals in his mind. He nodded. That's more like it. Now I want you to trust old Blake the Snake, old hoss. Old hoss. Coot liked the way that sounded. Chapter 8. The Lovable Lunatic. Vern held the baby against him and smelled her hair. She was his favorite thing in the world. He had never seen hair so soft, so red, so thick, that smelled so good. It was like somebody had rolled her in a field of daisies and let the flower smell get all over her. How could anything smell so good, he thought. Sometimes, though, the baby would make a grunting face, then poop on the person holding her, and that did not smell good. Vern sat beside Paul on the tailgate. They both watched Mr. Dreyfus inspect the white mill house. Only a few minutes earlier, the last board had been painted. Vern had stayed up all night. When the sun poked over the trees, the white building looked orange. It had taken a lot longer to build than Vern thought it would. And even though Paul wouldn't admit it, Vern knew it was because they were not young anymore. Vern had little streaks of white in his hair, and Paul was a full-blown old man with the stiff walk and all. The mill house was to be filled with all sorts of big machines for cutting pine. The whole world needed wood during these hard times. Paul had told Vern that Mr. Dreyfus was a crook who would bleed money from anything he could get his hands on, even trees. This mill house, Paul said, would bring Dreyfus a lot of money. Vern had spent 4 days painting the enormous structure. Yesterday he had painted while cradling the baby in one arm, which had slowed him. He would hold a brush with his left hand and the baby in his right arm. Or maybe it was the baby in his left arm and the brush in his right hand. He wasn't sure. Vern wasn't good with left and right. Most times, Vern had to hold both hands in front of him, sticking his thumbs and pointer fingers out to see which hand made the correct L. Though most times he forgot which way a correct L was supposed to be facing. Dreyfus's antebellum home sat on a hill behind the new mill house. His estate looked like a castle with fat columns and big porches and tall windows. It must have taken years to build, Vern thought. Maybe 10 years or more, depending on how many men he had. Mr. Dreyfus was a stiff man with hair the color of a raccoon, kind of silver and brown. The man ran his finger along the edge of the wet paint on the wood. I wouldn't go running my hands all over that, said Paul. Paint ain't dry yet. I thought, Mr. Dreyfus said, you were going to bring this roof line farther over the doors so rain wouldn't fall so close to the entrance. I never agreed to that, said Paul. I distinctly remember that we did. Vern watched Dreyfus's two men go over the barn with careful eyes. They were checking every joint and surface. It made him nervous for some reason. He held the child against his shoulder and gave her a little bounce because she liked it when he did that. She was happier when she was moving. She liked to always be moving. Mr. Dreyfus said, I thought those doors were going to be wider, and I ain't sure I'll be able to get my gang edger through the narrow opening. We measured it, said Paul. It'll fit.
You sure about that?
Sure as God made little green apples and beavers, sir.
Vern switched the baby to his other shoulder to give his right shoulder a rest, or maybe it was his left.
Well, I must say, you do slow work, Mr. Folger, said Dreyfus. You cost me a lot of time and money.
Then Mr. Dreyfus pointed to Vern.
I don't reckon that baby helped move things any faster. Your friend crawled all over this place with that baby latched onto him.
Paul kept his voice low like he did sometimes when he was angry. He never yelled when he got mad, not in all the years Vern had known him. He always made his voice quiet just before he lost his mind and lost every temper he had.
We've built your barn, said Paul. Without a crew, without a crane, without the two men you promised, without proper tools. Took us 10 days to finish setting those posts, just the two of us.
Well, I think a man ought to stand by his word, said Dreyfus. You said you'd finish on the 18th. It's the 30th.
And without no food, neither, Vern added. We ran out of food 2 nights ago.
Paul waved his hands at Vern, and this meant to hush. Vern knew this from lots of experience. Dreyfus went on.
How can a buyer expect to pay full price when the terms of his contract have been rendered inexplicably null?
And Paul Folger seemed to be letting those words sit in his mind for a little while, and so did Vern. Vern wasn't sure what rendered inexplicably null meant, but he knew ugly when he heard it. And he could tell Paul felt it, too, because his forehead went from tense to relaxed. Paul let a smile go across his face, and his ears moved backward like a dog's.
You know what? Said Paul. You're absolutely right. Ain't he, Vern?
Vern nodded slowly.
I think.
Inexplicably right, said Paul.
Vern wasn't sure what to say, so he adjusted the baby and said,
I'm real sorry about the baby, Mr. Dreyfus, but I couldn't leave her. She's all alone when I found her. Couldn't leave no baby.
Quit your sorrying, Vern, said Paul. Besides, ain't nothing to be sorry for. Mr. Dreyfus is right about us, and that's all there is to it. I know when I'm licked.
Paul searched in a toolbox, laughing to himself softly. Finally, he removed a rag. He uncorked the can of thinner and poured it onto the cloth.
What are you doing? Said Dreyfus.
Paul removed his pocket lighter. He lit a cigarette first, then touched the glowing end to the rag. It turned into fire.
Yes, sir, said Paul. Let's just pretend this whole thing never happened. You just have to get someone else to build you another barn.
Paul walked toward the barn.
Hey, shouted Dreyfus. Are you out of your mind?
Say what? Said Paul, cupping a hand over his ear.
Gotta speak up. This is my good ear. You've lost your mind.
Paul grinned, showing teeth that were a little crooked. He tossed the rag toward the wet paint beside the barn door. He put his thumbs behind the straps of his coveralls and watched the barn catch fire.
Dreyfus, said Paul, touching the brim of his hat. Have a nice day, sir.
Dreyfus ran to the fire. His men came running, too. They filled buckets with well water and tossed them onto the side of the burning barn. They were almost too late. A large piece of the siding had burned brown and black. When they put the fire out, Paul was leaning against the side of his truck, watching them. He was lighting another smoke, staring at the flame coming from his lighter like it had hypnotized him. Paul said,
How about you pay us what you agreed on and let us get out of your hair?
You're a lunatic, said Dreyfus.
Well, said Paul, holding the lighter just in front of his nose, God made me crazy to make up for how handsome I am.
Dreyfus paid cash.
Paul shoved the money into his chest pocket. He and Vern leapt into the truck. Vern tucked the baby's head just beneath his chin. She was beginning to fall asleep, and he didn't want to wake her. Paul yanked his gear shift and nodded toward the barn.
I ain't no expert, said Paul. But it looks like to me your barn could use a new coat of paint. Looks like it's about to be rendered inexplicably null.
The truck bounced down the driveway. Vern waved goodbye to Mr. Dreyfus. Mr. Dreyfus did not wave back. Paul patted Vern's shoulder and said, don't worry about that old goat. He's just having a bad day.
But do you think he likes the barn?
Likes it? Why, he loves it. It's the prettiest barn he ever saw.
This pleased Vern. He fell asleep smelling that baby's beautiful hair. Chapter 9. Brave Girls. The land around the bay looked like heaven itself. It was different from the mountain town she'd come from, a town plopped on the big ridge of Trinity Mountain, not far from the Tennessee River. But here, everything was different. Even the soil was different. It was not black and brown like it was in Trinity, but red and sandy in some places. There were no peaks and valleys, no hills. There were only shallow swales of land that fell right into the enormous bay. Gold grass flats shot out for miles into the water. Birds everywhere. It was warm, salty-aired. It was a kind of heaven, no matter how you looked at it.
Maggie, said Marigold. I'm coming, Maggie.
Marigold wandered the shoreline, staggering toward the place she remembered. Now and then, she became lightheaded and had to sit. Her legs were shaky. Her stomach was empty. She was running on pure willpower. She was reduced to a slow walk. When she reached a fence post with a green ribbon tied around it, she veered left. She climbed over deep canals, looking for her next ribbon. When she reached the red puddle of standing water, she clomped right through it instead of going around. She walked deeper into the woods. She spotted poison ivy and steered clear. Marigold was allergic to poison ivy. Her mother said it was one of the curses of being a redhead. But she had never let it scare her. It was part of growing up in the forests of Trinity. She gasped for air. Her heart was beating slow but hard. The air was so hot she could taste it. The sun had turned the humidity surrounding the bay into steam and made her dress damp. Her hunger had become confusion. She was so thirsty her body burned all over. Her breasts were swollen and throbbing. They began leaking, and the top of her dress was soaked. When she reached the gnarled oak with a ribbon on its branch, she was near camp. She spotted her canvas tent in the distance, and she almost started crying when she saw it.
Maggie, hold on. I'm coming.
She trotted toward the tent, moving as fast as she was able. She fell once. Her knee hit an exposed root. Her white knee started to bleed. It was thick, slow-moving, dark blood. When she got closer, she saw the fire pit of ash. She entered the white canvas tent and saw the empty pine straw bed. Her body felt empty. She became cold all over. She was not brave like the old man in her vision had said. She was a coward. She was scared. She was terrified. She screamed Maggie's name and frightened the birds away for miles. This place was anything but heaven. Chapter 10. Why Blake Hickok. The E.P. Wheeler Gospel Troop tumbled into Hickok on gasoline fumes and parked in a field behind a gas station. They spent the afternoon setting up the large circus tent in an open field. The red crucifix hanging atop the tallest post was so high it looked no bigger than a crimson dot against the dusk clouds. At sunset, E.P. had taken the choir into a local diner to eat supper. It was the same old song and dance E.P. did in every new town he visited. E.P. would buy things on credit, sweet talk to shop owners, and tell outrageous stories. He'd start tabs at restaurants, drugstores, grocers, and department stores. Then he would leave town without paying his bills. He'd done this all over the South, back East, and now in the Midwest. He'd left a trail of debts behind him 100,000 miles long, and often he left the broken hearts of naive young women in his wake. Once he got caught skipping town outside Pretty Prairie. He had to spend 2 nights in jail, but E.P. was a charmer. Before his sentence was up, E.P. had led 2 deputies to salvation and baptized the sheriff's sister. That night, Blake and Coot didn't join the others for supper. Instead, they sat in their wagon. For supper, Coot ate canned beans. Blake chewed half a cigar and drank a Coca-Cola. Blake was too busy to eat. His hands were occupied with something more important. Blake poured cough syrup from a small bottle into a peanut jar. He stirred it with a fork until the peanut butter became soupy. Then he crushed white pills with the blade of his pocket knife and added the powder to the mixture. "You're not going to kill him, are you?" asked Coot with a mouthful of pintos. "Lord, no," said Blake. "I ain't feeling that generous."
"What is that stuff?"
"Laudanum," he said. "Granny's cough syrup. Used to give it to horses to calm them down in the horse shows."
"Back when you were a cowboy?"
"Back when I was whatever I was."
"Do we have to give that stuff to him? I mean, can't we just run away once he falls asleep?"
"Sure we can. You don't mind getting whooped like a rented mule."
"He can't whoop us if he can't catch us."
"Yeah, he can catch us.
Not if we're fast."
"I once saw that ape beat your mama to a pulp when she tried leaving him, God rest her soul. She's laid up for weeks because of it, back when she was pregnant with you. And don't forget about your busted neck, old hoss." Coot remembered the beatings his mother endured from the hands of E.P. She would try to hide her bruises from Coot, but he saw them. He remembered the way her face looked when she would run from E.P.'s tent. He remembered the fear. "You're lucky he didn't really hurt you this time, Coot. Next time, you might not be so lucky."
"Why doesn't he like me, Blake?"
Blake dropped his eyes. He stopped mixing and seemed to be thinking. It was as if he had something to say, but couldn't.
Don't I always do what he says? Coot went on. Don't I always do it?
He don't like himself, Coot.
I don't know why. Everybody else sure does.
No, he don't like himself because he considers himself a failure. Man like E.P. expected to be somebody one day. Somebody famous, but it didn't ever happen. He just stuck in this godforsaken dust like everybody else.
He hates me.
He hates everybody. Most of all, he hates folks who won't throw more than a few pennies into the offering bucket. Blake mixed the peanut butter hard and fast. The sound of the fork against the tin made a clipping noise and rhythm. Then he stopped and touched the fork to his tongue. He tasted it with closed eyes, then spit it out. Did you know that E.P. used to be friends with J. Wilbur Chaplin? He said. Coop made a face. I'm serious, said Blake. Back before Chaplin was famous, they traveled together, did revivals together. E.P. knew J. Wilbur Chaplin? You better believe it. How long ago? Oh, long before the world fell apart and turned into dust. Was E.P. famous? No, but neither was J. Wilbur. They were just two farm boys screaming hellfire and brimstone for Jesus. Blake crushed more pills with a jackknife. Then he pointed the knife at Coot. Why, when J. Wilbur rolls into Kansas City, Little Rock, St. Louis, or wherever he is, he don't even use tents like we do. He makes people build wood buildings, big tall ones, so they don't get blowed down by the wind or the rain. Wood buildings? More like wood tents, and his own train car, servants, and fancy food. People who iron his breeches and everything. Probably uses a golden toilet and has a hired fellow who sings to him while he does his business. Wood tents? They build them bigger than baseball diamonds. You seen them? Shoot, several times. And when J. Wilbur leaves town, they just tear them down and reuse the wood. Coop could hardly wrap his mind around this, but he tried. He closed his eyes and imagined a big building made of wood with millions of people inside. Peons like us got to set up our own dadgum cotton tents like everybody else, said Blake. And instead of thousands, we get a handful of dirt farmers. Do you think E.P. would really fight you? Well, I know he would, Blake thought about this for a moment. We come to a few blows before.
Well, who won?
Well, sometimes he wins on account of his size. Blake tapped his temple with his finger. Sometimes I win on account of experience.
Can't we just leave?
Blake chuckled. I'm too old to fight, and you're too scrawny. He held the peanut butter to the light. This is the best way. Blake jerked his head up at the sound of a car.
Coot almost choked on his beans when he heard E.P.'s footsteps in the dirt. Blake and Coop peeked through the canvas flaps of the wagon. They could see E.P. lighting a cigarette, walking inside his tent and reading a newspaper all at the same time. They heard a radio next. The radio was blaring hot house music. Tinny trumpets filled the night air. Blake spoke in a quiet voice, outlining their plan one more time. When he was sure Coot understood what to do, he reached beneath the cot and handed something to Coot. It was a long box wrapped in newspaper and twine.
I got something for you, said Blake.
What's this? Asked Coot.
The box was long as a man's leg and heavy. Coot could only stare at it, for he'd never received a gift that was any bigger than a pack of baseball cards.
Well, go on, said Blake. It'll rot in your lap if you just look at it.
Coot tore the paper. Inside was a long cylinder of white hickory, fat on one end, skinny on the other. The words Louisville Slugger were burned onto the fat part. Hot tears were building in his eyes. He'd never touched a bat before. He'd only used pine branches to hit balls during community games in strange towns with kids who didn't even know how to play. Coot was overcome. Blake put his arm around Coot. Don't get too choked up, old hoss. That bat ain't for pleasure. It's for when E.P. catches me and tries to rip my face off. I expect you to rescue me.
I love you, Blake, said Coot.
Well, you got terrible taste in friends. Chapter 11. Cotton Men. Paul had never seen harder times than these.